Hello, you're listening to the Academy Securities Geopolitical and Macro Strategy Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Robinson. This episode is a recording from a webinar that we held on April 9th, 2024. Rachel Washburn is the moderator for this webinar and introduces our guests and the conversation.
Thank you everyone for joining today's discussion, our geopolitical webinar focused on an update on the Israel-Gaza war. Lots to discuss, lots of interesting things that have happened in the last couple of weeks. So thrilled to be joined by General Spider Marks, our head of geopolitical strategy today, General Mastin Robison, another one of our geopolitical advisory board members, and of course, Peter Chur, our head of macro strategy. Today, our discussion is brought to you by the Academy Vets ETF, a veteran impact ETF focused on providing market-based returns while investing in mortgage-backed and asset-backed securities that support veterans. Vets with a Z invests in residential mortgage loans to active duty service members and to veterans, as well as loans to veteran-owned small businesses. To learn more, please visit academyetfs.com or contact your broker. The Academy Vets ETF is offered by Academy Asset Management, the asset management affiliate of Academy Securities, a registered broker-dealer. General Spider Marks, would love to start with you. We are about 6 months into this conflict. Can you lay the framework for what has happened and how it's evolved over the last recent months and how you see the conflict today?
Thank you, Rachel, and great to be on with you guys. And everybody, thank you for joining us today. What we've seen over the course of the last 6 months is a well-intentioned effort on the part of the IDF to crush and eliminate the leadership of Hamas. And it's really kind of been an overuse of power and influence on the part of the Israelis. At this point, they have done, I would say, a rather successful job of going after the leadership. The downside of that is that there has been this not surprising global response and condemnation of Israel because of the result of collateral damage and the killing of Palestinians, albeit Hamas is, that's exactly what Hamas was hoping would happen. Where we are today, I think we're at a turning point. We have been for a while. Israel continues to offer up options for a ceasefire. They continue to be denied and turned away by Hamas, probably for two reasons. One is, as I indicated, Hamas benefits the longer this is dragged out. They can continue to resist as best they can. There is zero concern on the part of Hamas in terms of the Palestinian casualties. Yet the world sees this and is now labeling this a genocide inappropriately, but that's where we are. And that's number one. Hamas gains as long as this continues to play out, and Israel suffers greatly. And that's what Hamas is hoping for. I think the second thing is, it's probably fair to say that the hostages that Hamas still holds probably have either already died, have been killed, or already dead, or those that remain certainly have been in the hands of Hamas, have been mistreated, maybe fair to say tortured. And if they were to be released now, as a result of a ceasefire, those voices would become very, would be magnified, and there would be a fracture in terms of this global condemnation for Israel. So I don't think that's going to happen, and that's why the ceasefire right now does not seem likely. The key thing at this point is with the cessation of the WCK operations in Gaza as a result of the strike mission, the strike that killed seven of their workers last week. We could talk about that if you want. Humanitarian assistance for Palestinians is now extremely spotty. We've got the U.S. pier that may show up, the over-the-shore pier that may show up by the end of month, May, and be operational. There are considerable risks associated with that, but that remains to be seen. So we're at the point where Israel is drawing down some of its forces from Gaza. They have a final mission in Rafah that I would anticipate they will execute. The timing remains to be seen, but then you have the backdrop of the lack of a ceasefire, decrease in terms of humanitarian assistance, and certainly this cacophonous voice that continues to rise up in terms of the hatred for what Israel is doing in Gaza. And again, I'd be naive if I didn't indicate that our U.S. administration now is very boisterous in terms of the qualification of the support that they're going to give Israel. Let me stop right there, Rachel.
Yeah, I appreciate that overview and in that perspective. General Robison, would love to hear your point of view on the conflict as well, especially as it relates to how Iran is now a big part of the fabric of this conflict and how we evaluate the ongoing conflict.
Great intro by Spider. And I think there are so many things outside of Israel and Gaza that are adjusting, adapting, and changing that are of concern. Iran certainly seems to have a greater level of influence than they did before this began. Their proxies, which number somewhere between 14 and 20 in that region, have become far more active. It was initially encouraging to see that Egypt and Jordan were no more interested in opening up the gates and accepting the radical Hamas into their countries, how that will change over time, and how we, the U.S., will maintain or not maintain our influence in the Middle East when it comes to isolating Iran and solidifying Middle Eastern countries that prior to this had some pretty good synergy going on with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and some others. So how that impacts the long term, I think, will be certainly key to U.S. interests and whether or not we come out of this worse than we went into it, less influential and less ability to bring long term peace and stability to the area.
Yeah. Appreciate that. And with that sort of overview and the table being set, want to welcome the audience to participate in today's discussion. At the bottom of your screen, there is a Q&A icon. If you have any questions as we go through the webinar, please put them there and we'll be addressing them throughout the discussion. So General Robison, want to pull on the thread that you kind of started. Obviously, the relationship with Israel is one of strategic significance for the U.S., but we're seeing some political differences in messaging when it comes to the conflict in Gaza. Can you talk about maybe some historical examples of where that friction has existed in the past and how the U.S. and Israel navigate those challenges when the overlying relationship is always going to be so important?
Yeah, great question. I think it's fair to frame that the vast majority of what we, the U.S., have been engaged with Israel over the past 50 years has been as much the relationship between Israel and the Palestinian authorities or the Palestinian people, whoever they chose to rule there. And as we know, that shifted back in the early 2000s to Hamas stepping into a leadership role there. So that was a small scenario compared to what we're facing now. So we certainly face a much broader conflict. I think our having been in Iraq for as long as we were, for any place in the world where we went in and we spend years or even decades and we come out without any solution there, historically speaking, that gets backfilled with a void that generally is not conducive to our interest. And that certainly has happened in that part of the world as we have withdrawn post-Iraq war. And that's not a criticism to the withdrawal. It's just a fact that we no longer control that. And that's what's going to happen. You're going to have nefarious actors that backfill in and that have, in essence, backers in the region, which Iran has very effectively done. So I don't know that I know of a time looking back in our relationship with Israel and with the PLO where we were, I hate to say out of balance or lopsided, because we really tried to balance between what Israel was doing, what the Palestinian people were doing, and tried to broker a fairness here as much as we could. Now, that would blow up every time you would have Syria or Egypt or other Arab countries, take it to the next level, unsuccessfully in the past each time. But still, that then would have a minor micro blow up, and you would try to tamp it back down and get it back to where we have two groups of people trying to share similar territory as peacefully as we can align it.
General Marks, would love your take on the same question.
Well, historically, the United States, bear in mind, the United States was the first nation to recognize a sovereign Israel. And that was not done easily. President Truman got a lot of pushback, primarily from his Secretary of State, George Marshall, inarguably the most incredible scholar, warrior, statesman this nation has ever produced. So there's always been some difficulty in terms of the path that the United States has been on with Israel, yet it has been inexorably moving in the direction of support and advocacy. 56, Eisenhower gave Israel a very clear message. You need to get out of the Sinai. They had moved into the Sinai. You can't solve this problem yourself. And so it was crystal clear that there has been some division. 73 war, Kissinger and Nixon had to figure out how they were going to support Israel in their fight. The support eventually occurred, but it was late, and there was some legitimate hesitation on the part of the U.S. administration in terms of how that would appear to the greater Arab world, if you will. So we've always had a conditions-based relationship with Israel. And as a result of the Abraham Accords, we really saw the opportunity for the Arab world to begin to step up and recognize Israel in terms, if not direct diplomatic recognition, but in terms of some trust building measures that would allow the eventual, some type of a peaceful type of a relationship that at least would drop the temperature in terms of those longstanding fractures that existed in that part of the world. That went sideways, obviously, on 7 October of last year. And that was part of the intent of Hamas, is to kind of throw a wedge into that process. I think the Abraham Accords will continue to pick up. But the problem we see now is the horizon for the conclusion of this fight, whatever conclusion, however we define conclusion, however we define next step, what Gaza next is going to look like, no one really knows right now. There's lots of speculation. But that has a much longer horizon than we thought on the morning of 7 October or the evening of 7 October. We thought this might be a quick, much quicker fight than it was. This has much longer and deeper roots than we anticipated. So those challenges will continue to exist.
Yep, certainly. And Peter, would love to hear your point of view from a macro perspective, especially how it's evolved over the last 6 months, when the initial events occurred, and if we did think this was going to be maybe a quickly resolved issue, obviously not. So how have you seen the macro implications evolve, and can you forecast where you think they may be going?
Yeah, I'm going to start back a little bit. And a couple months ago, we put out a report about the game of chicken. And it's a pretty simple game, right? You go at each other and either you swerve or you don't swerve. And it's also really, if you take a game theory course, it's where you start, because it's such a simple game on the surface, but it's much more complex. And it got us to the potential to bring up a couple other things, this kind of concept of mirroring, where when you look at these actions, you place your own value on the opposition or even your allies, and that's not necessarily true. And so I think what we're seeing here is this game is really changing, right? It's how we view the perception of what Israel should be doing is not quite what Israel views themselves. And I think how we're viewed in terms of our help or aid for Israel and our willingness to clamp down on Iran is changing. And so some of that's changing, I think, both this game, as both sides look at how people are behaving, what can I get away with, what are they likely to do? And I think probably more problematically is, what's this do with countries like China too, who are saying, oh, if we're going to play a game of chicken in the US, what have we learned from this? And I think we've shown probably more divisiveness, more, I almost want to say, our desire to eat our cake and have it too, where we take for granted that people will follow what we tell them to do or what we want to do. And it's not been playing out that way. And for me, probably the biggest thing that this has exposed is we've been writing about this for over a year, is inflation is kind of the U.S. Achilles heel. We saw when inflation spiked, you know, how problematic it was for the incumbents, how problematic it was for the economy. And I just can't help looking that at Iran selling 3.5 million barrels per oil per day, the fact that we haven't refilled the strategic petroleum reserve much at all since we drew down on it, that we are being very cautious in how we treat this because of our fear about a short-term spike in oil. And I don't think that's necessarily what we should be doing. I think we should be doing what's, you know, right and necessary. But to the extent that's playing in, I think that's an important piece of information our enemies are learning, is we really are very scared of inflation. And that to me is the biggest wild card in this. And it's why I think markets are reacting now as we kind of get to this risk of escalation and expansion where Iran gets dragged in. Will we continue to allow them to sell that oil? If not, does oil go to $100 per barrel? And what happens to our economy and the election?
Yeah, certainly one of the places where these macro implications have been the most clear is within shipping and supply chain challenges as Houthi rebels continue to attack shipping vessels. So one of the questions from the audience is in that vein. General Robison, would love your point of view on the threat to closing down the Straits of Hormuz and just general threats to logistics and shipping in the region.
Yeah. Let's start with the threat that is right there in the area in Yemen. It's hard to see Yemen being a holistic country, which they were 10 years ago. It's further off track now with greater Iranian influence, with Saudi having pulled back and the Houthis being successful. So that doesn't bode well for this being a short-term duration of an issue. It bodes for a very decentralized enemy that is fully embedded into the population, into the territory, and very, very difficult to root out, and certainly not a place that we're probably likely to put ground troops to go through and try to root them out. So it runs the risk of this being not a short-term disruption of a very, very key shipping lane from the Bab el-Mandab Strait on the southern end of the Red Sea and the Suez Canal on the northern end, which drives everything from pricing to timing to supply chain backlog to insurance costs, as well as just shipping industry and the health of shipping industry, and how long will we be able to do this, and what does it slow down on the economic side? It certainly emboldens and empowers Iran's ability to have a major influence on the economics of the world globally, purely and simply by supporting and turning on one of the proxies that they have in the area, which in and of itself is a dangerous habit for us to see Iran to begin, because that could certainly become very, very problematic with the other Islamic choke points that are around the world if Iran is successful at creating similar type proxy forces in those areas as well.
You know, Rachel, if I can jump in real quickly, in response to what Peter said, which I really appreciated when he said, you characterized it that Iran may be dragged into this fight. What you're really saying is Iran doesn't want an expanded war, a regional war. They may be dragged into it. And on the heels of what Masson just said, all of these proxies work within certain parameters and agreements that they have with Tehran. Tehran acquiesces to their behavior as long as it comports to what they've agreed to. So I'm not sure that Tehran turns it on, turns it off, but they'll turn a blind eye to that type of increased behavior because it's an accepted norm. The only way you arrest that is not to go after each one of these proxies, albeit that's our strategy, but there has to be an outside in type of a pressure against Tehran itself. And there's no way, Peter has mentioned this, there's no way that any U.S. administration would do this, which is essentially, let's cut off all Iranian oil. They still pump, what, Peter, 3.5 million barrels a day? Let's cut that off and just bottle them up in the Gulf and watch oil prices skyrocket and watch political opportunity decrease for any candidate. That's the conundrum that we're faced with. But you're not going to solve the problem just by trying to beat up on a bunch of proxies.
Another question from the audience, as it relates to other activity in the region by Israel. How do you guys view the increased activity in Syria by Israel while they're waging a full-scale war in Gaza? Any thoughts on what triggered those activities, and then maybe what a proportional or a potential response by Iran could look like based off of those attacks? General Marks, first to you.
I would say that what that demonstrates is there is an immense amount of capacity that the IDF and the Israeli government has in terms of intelligence collection, and then the ability to act on that intelligence. Multiple lines of effort. They can maintain multiple lines of effort simultaneously, which is quite amazing as you look at what their engagement is in Gaza. But they can go after targets in Syria with great effect, knowing exactly what they're doing. I can only speculate that really two things. Iranian response will not have direct fingerprints on their IRGC. Again, it'll be through the application of force by proxies. What that looks like, we can anticipate asymmetric kind of attacks. You could see the use of drones. I'm confident you will not see IRGC, Iranian fast movers going after targets in Israel, because they can't get there from here. I mean, the Israelis would shoot them down. The Iraqis might shoot them down, don't know. But I don't think you'd see that. But the second thing is, again, Iran doesn't want to be tied up in these multiple fights, these multiple pressure points that exist in the region, because that will detract from what their position is. As Mastin said, the narrative that they come across with, which is they want to have a kind of above the fray type of approach, which gives them the high ground and puts them on the offensive diplomatically.
General.
I would add to that, as Spider talked about them being above the fray, the real issue is they're creating a chaotic fray that they can be above that allows them a position to hover. So back to your first question, I think Israel's being pretty smart, because the last thing they want is to let Lebanese Hezbollah have a coordinated, schemed attack on that flank. So by continuing to be disruptive there, they keep them off balance. And I agree with what Joe Mark said of the incredible collection capability, incredible capacity, as well as capability to engage. And I also agree that Iran really wants to continue to do the damage they're doing and still be able to go, what, me? I mean, that's not us, that's them. So the key is at what point does not just the U.S., but does the Middle East go, wow, Iran is really getting a lot of leverage here, and that isn't good for Saudi Arabia, it's not good for Bahrain, it's not good for UAE, it's not good for the entire Middle East. How do we start trying to facilitate a better control, isolation, clampdown of what this explosion of, or seeming explosion of influence Iran is having with pretty capable proxy forces by merely throwing some dollars at them? To be able to allow them to continue not just have a short spike of disruption and chaos, but a longer glide path of disruption and chaos.
And given the attacks in Syria, there was implications made by Iran that the U.S. was involved or to some degree knew about it. What is the risk to U.S. interest in the area should Iran retaliate?
The U.S. has a presence in Iraq. We have a presence elsewhere in the region. Obviously, we've got a fleet in Bahrain, and we routinely transit the area. The U.S. is a target, very much so. And I don't anticipate that there would be any effort on the part of the Iranians to exercise restraint in that regard. I think intelligence collection will continue. Targeting will continue. The United States is in a position to be at enhanced risk. The key question is, it's like a boxing match. You know, you punch, you counterpunch, and you punch again. What does this look like for the United States if, in fact, there is an attack against a very precise attack against U.S. presence in that region? What form is that going to take? Is that going to be in a consulate someplace in the region, disconnected directly to this fight in Gaza? How is this going to play out? Those are the concerns. The United States has been here before. We know how to put our guard up, and we know how to get our intelligence collection network out there to get ahead of that. But this is the concern that I have, this form of escalation.
And let me just add one point to that, because we have incredible capability, but we don't necessarily have incredible capacity right now. And with two carrier battle groups out there and a MEU that just returned, our ability to replace that at like level is not there right now. We've got some gaps in our shipping coverage. And so we're going to find creative ways to continue to have the same military presence that provides influence and threat and strike capability as we get deeper into this. The longer it goes into this, the tougher it will be for the U.S. to continue to roll over like capabilities and presence in the areas that we want to try to influence.
Peter, in that vein, as the conflict continues to expand out into the region, how are you seeing the risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think we get a lot of questions. Okay, geopolitical risk is out there. Jamie Dimon mentioned it yesterday. People are talking about it. And, you know, I've got the honor and the privilege of working with the Geopolitical Intelligence Group. And how I'm trying to frame this into the macro is I try and look at it almost from two ways. What is a tactical answer we can get, and what is strategic? So tactical, I would say, for example, is Straits of Hormuz. What's the risk? And as the generals have said, right, it's very difficult for someone else to shut it down. We could shut it down if we want. And so we can react to that. I would say longer term, for the last, you know, probably a year, we've been telling clients not to take shipping for granted. And when they're looking at what their business plans are supposed to look going down the road, shipping is becoming an issue, right? China's expanding its footprint in the South China Sea area. You've got problems, you know, weather-related, but in the Panama Canal, or sorry, you know, climate-related, however you want to call it. But this is yet another, I don't want to say nail in the coffin, but almost a nail in the coffin of how are we supposed to think as companies about shipping? And what things do you need to be closer to home? What things do you not want to transit around the world? And so I think that's kind of the tricky part in a lot of this geopolitical is, what is kind of tactical can help you guide through the next days and weeks? And what do you need to be thinking about for the next 6 months to 3 or 4 years? And I think on that, we've been spot on this kind of pulling away from China, and people who've listened to us from benefited. I think you're going to see this in shipping. And again, I think in terms of energy, this, I think once we're done our election, regardless of which side wins, we'll see a lot more pressure or support for domestic energy, where there's going to be, I think, a recommitment to how do we get our traditional energy sources working better efficiently for the next 10 to 30 years? And how do we build out sustainability? So to me, a lot of this is really still around the energy, what that's going to drive us. And all of this just is, I think, strategically pulling us further apart from the globe. And we're going to become more and more independent, where we rely on either ourselves, Canada, Mexico, South America, things where we have better line of sight. And that's kind of the big takeaway from there. And I think we now have to be prepared because of how this event's gone on. I think if you asked any of us October 7th, what would this look like a month, 2 months down the road, we're not where we thought we'd be. And I think places like North Korea, places like China are all seeing our response, all seeing how difficult we have maybe having a coordinated view, and are going to use that against us. So I think near term, you have to be prepared for more shocks, geopolitical with economic repercussions. And the easiest way for me to see that happening is through the energy markets or commodity markets. And again, that ties back to this long-term strategic, where China has been working very closely with the autocratic resource-rich nations to develop supply chains. And I think we saw one question in here about sanctions. I think sanctions are less and less effective by the day as the rest of the world starts saying, well, we can deal around the system. And I think, you know, the epitome of that has been North Korea delivering weapons into Russia, right? That starts making any sort of sanctions we do very ineffective.
Yeah, and a very interesting, you've had some interesting thoughts over the last few years about how nations are choosing to avoid that and how crypto can play into that. And I want to stay with you, Peter, for a second and keep with the questions from the audience. How are you viewing geopolitical risk as a factor in how the Fed may evolve their rates policy?
Yeah, I think it's going to mean that it's going to be difficult to cut more than twice this year. I think we are going to see this, you know, short-term pressure on energy as we're still not fully priced into a disruption. And I think that chance of a disruption is there. But I think for the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to have this kind of reshifting of how we think about the world, how we do sort of our supply chains, how we think about energy. And that's going to add some base level of inflation that we have not seen in a long time. So I think the Fed's going to have this quote unquote sticky inflation is going to be real. We're not going to be able to cut in the way. And I think the most difficult thing is when I'm talking to investors, well, how do we hedge this? I keep coming back to, you want to be long energy or something. Is in a traditional environment, what you get is yields rally. Everyone gets scared. So we have this flight to safety. And I think that flight to safety is less likely to occur because it's going to be, one, directly involved in energy inflation, which we have not dealt with well. And two, I think people are going to quickly extrapolate this to more and more government spending on military, not just domestically, but across the globe. So I think yields actually have a propensity to go higher, and there's very little I think the Fed can do about that. And that's one of the problems with this. It's out of our control. And I know it's kind of off topic, but I keep swearing that this year I'm going to mention India sooner than later in every one of these conversations. And you look at the growth that's starting to occur in India. They're starting to get their act together. I've talked to or spoken to several people who come back from India, and they're even seeing like a change in attitude there. There's always been this like, yeah, it's good now, but it's not going to be good in the future. There's this real belief. And I think that turns on, we are now going to have a new competitor for resources, right? As India builds out, as every person moves slightly up that economic ladder, there's going to be more money being spent there. And that's something we don't talk enough about, I think, on the geopolitical side. And yet it should be, if not number one or two, it's got to be up there. Because I think the India growth is a huge potential for us. But there is a commodity risk, and all those reasons are why I think we're not going to see commodity prices come down. That's going to influence inflation, and it's going to keep the Fed relatively on hold. And you're going to hear more and more talk, I think, about R-star or what the neutral rate of rates are, and I think it's going to be higher. I think we live in a world, again, much more like 2005 to 2007 when China was starting to become a real economic superpower, and that's going to keep rates higher, and that's something we should all be prepared for.
We have a few questions in the audience that are at the tactical level in about the Israel-Gaza conflict, but I want to take a moment to pivot where Peter's trying to take us and talk strategic for a moment, because obviously all these things, these elements are intertwined. So General Marks, you for a long time have been banging the drum around India being this great opportunity for the U.S. to partner, and they are at times in active conflict, armed conflict on their border with one of our biggest strategic competitors, China. So can you just take a moment, a little sequitur into where opportunity exists at a political and military level with India and how that relationship is currently evolving?
Yeah, great question. You know, Rachel, Peter just indicated, And I love listening to Peter talk about India. And I love the way you always feel challenged that you can't get it up front soon enough, which is perfect. But what you've characterized it by saying India is getting its act together. I'm paraphrasing. United States needs to get its act together as well in terms of how we want to craft this relationship with India. And we've not done that successfully. I think we have a historical challenge when we view India. And we need to get beyond that. India is, let's be frank, it's a great relationship to have transactionally. You invest money in India, there's lots of opportunity for growth. So you can do well by doing good. And that needs to be kind of the approach we take. But more importantly, India, world's largest democracy, is increasingly autocratic. We've got to have a much stronger relationship with Modi and embrace what we can about that. There's a lot of hair around some internal politics that he has between Muslim and Hindu in broad strokes, those kinds of fractures that exist. We have to be able to acknowledge that that is an issue, but it's one that we're not going to solve. What we need to be able to do at our strategic, at the strategic level, is there doesn't necessarily have to be a counterbalance, but if we have a solid relationship with India that gives us the opportunity to grow, it gives China pause and it can put the initiative, gives us back the initiative. We can reclaim the initiative. That's the most important thing. India does its own thing right now. The sanctions against Russia have been essentially feckless. Russia's economy certainly is in a very, very deep hole. I mean, it's economy. What is it, Peter? 1.4 trillion. And you look at the combined economy of NATO and the United States is in excess of 50 trillion. And so it eclipses China and Russia. And I mean, it's quite phenomenal. But it's been able to maintain external relationships with partners like India, where they're going to, you know, oil is fungible. India will buy its oil from Russia. Russia lost some oil clients, gained some new clients in the form of India, for example, and China, certainly in advance of 7 October. This is the problem that we have. I don't know how inside our administration, discussions about India don't get more fulsome and deep. Where are the very tangible areas where we can have good relationships? If I looked at it through a military, foreign military sales filter, India has always been kind of a very eclectic catch bin of military support. They buy from the French, they buy from the Brits, they buy from the Russians, they buy from the United States. Where is their primary supplier? The United States could very easily step up and say, we want to be able to take that position of primacy and eliminate a whole bunch of your maintenance and sustainability issues. We can do that for you. And we can do that at a very reduced price. It's good for India. It's good for ourselves through that perspective. In terms of its relationship, we for the last two decades had tried to establish a very strong relationship with Pakistan. Mastin and I have very, very deep scar tissue in terms of our reliance on that relationship relative to our efforts in Afghanistan. And it didn't work to our advantage, obviously. How can we now turn that to a rather stable politically India relative to a relatively chaotic political Pakistan and work that to our advantage?
General Robson, anything to add on the India topic?
Yeah, well, I think you got to expand the topic because I agree that once you drive a good stake in the ground in India and have strong relationships there, it just really opens things up for your relationship with Japan, your relationship with Australia, where's the threat with Taiwan, China. It influences China hugely. It influences Russia hugely. But I do think that we've historically tried to say South Korea, Japan, you know, there's our footholds on the Pacific Rim, and those are valuable and they're important to maintain and to nurture. India is absolutely the place that we need to be driving a stake in the ground. And when you look at the threat to the South China Sea, there's nobody as capable as India is of being to facilitate safe passage of goods and services through the South China Sea as India is in relationship with us.
Appreciate that. I want to keep it on the strategic level for a moment. Question from the audience about all the attention focused in the Middle East, does that have an implication for any risk for China attacking Taiwan? General Robson would like your point of view on this.
I don't know that it has a direct risk of China attacking Taiwan. I think the bigger issue there is, and you're seeing it now with, you know, the administration saying we can't just be overcommitted to the Middle East. So, you know, tomorrow night there's a state dinner and you've got, you know, both Tokyo and as well as the Philippines that will be there this week having talks with the administration. And that's a strong signal to our commitment to the Pacific Rim and the Indochina Pacific. And it sends a strong signal to China. Taiwan certainly will be fascinating to see how that plays out over the next 5 years. There's always been a strong, opinion that China's best chance to win Taiwan, the one China state, is through political means, not through military means. The ability to grow a candidate in Taiwan that can win, that is committed to one China, certainly bodes well for China. It's not what we want to see. We want to see a Taiwan that's independent. And we want to see a Taiwan that continues to give us the benefits of partnering with a China-like economy, such as chips and super chips, that are not China-China, but they are Taiwan-China. So I think we've been very successful at helping Taiwan manage and prepare for the defense of their island and a cross-strait invasion from China that is going to make it very difficult for China to do without a lot of casualties. I think the flip side of that is, as Taiwan has watched the Russian-Ukraine scenario, because much of what we facilitated Ukraine to do was what we've been working for a decade plus, really 2 decades, to help Taiwan take a similar approach in the defense of their nation. So it's one thing to say we were not conquered and captured. It's another one to say this is now a protracted war, and that's not really where we want to be either. So do we need bigger things? And so you have that now coming out of Taiwan of saying we can't just use stingers and javelins. We got to have some big stuff. We got to have some things that really no kidding gives us to reach the China mainland and hurt them if they're going to come cross strait, that we can go deep into China to try to influence their appetite to not come cross strait, and that threat is real.
That's interesting. And Peter, do you have any thoughts on how you evaluate that risk from an economic perspective with the backdrop of what's happening globally?
Yeah, and again, I think it just highlights that China, you know, has this multi-pronged approach, right? There's clearly the military threat. There's clearly the, you know, trying to influence their elections. They're at the same time trying to build out their own chip industry capacity as aggressively as they can, because, again, so long as TSMC is kind of the biggest provider of high quality, the highest quality chips, that's a leverage they have. So China's trying to erode that at every step of the way. And again, I think strategically, this is where, you know, China is doing this across the board. Had a conversation with one of our other geopolitical advisory board members lately, where China has been making a big effort with some degree of success to include a certain spectrum in 5 and 6G bandwidth across the globe, where domestically we actually have it reserved for our radar systems. So again, China, I think it's not just with Taiwan, everywhere, they're trying to take all these little steps. They have, you know, tens, if not hundreds of plans in motion. They won't all work, but to erode and kind of get what they want. And again, something as simple as if they're able to make it the global standard, that bandwidth or that spectrum that we use for radar is in 6G chips. Well, our 6G chips won't be as good because it won't include it, or it's going to have the sharing. And again, gives a Huawei that sort of competitive advantage and gets their equipment into these countries. So I think what they're doing with Taiwan is a microcosm of the world. Maybe the military threat to Taiwan is much more overt than the military threat to the rest of the world. But all the other steps and actions they're taking, including, I would assume they are going to be very active in trying to, you know, fix the outcome of our election. I don't know which way they're going to want to go, but it seems if we had, you know, Russian collusion and issues 4 years ago, given the status of where AI is today, how bots behave, you know, I think China's ability to do something like that here should not be, you know, taken for, you know, underestimated, right? It's whatever we're seeing, I think, in Taiwan, we should start using as a microcosm for their competition with us.
That's really interesting. I want to do take a moment. We got some questions from the audience that relate to Russia, not just Ukraine, but the terror attack in Moscow. So I'm going to kind of fold a couple questions into this. General Marks, first, any thoughts about how the attack in Moscow, does it have anything to do with the rising tensions in the Middle East? And then in conjunction with that, if Russia wasn't so preoccupied with the war that they started in Ukraine, how would you see them participating in the conflict, given their interests in Syria and the Middle East generally?
Interesting. I think the attack in Moscow was an opportunity. The ISIS-K, I think it's safe to say, the assessment is ISIS-K conducted the attack over the course of most likely very deep intelligence collection, planning, rehearsals, et cetera, and were able to execute this thing. I think it's safe to say there was no linkage in terms of any relationship between that element that conducted the attack and the ongoing war in Ukraine, albeit there were indications that they were en route Ukraine post-attack. They were hoping that would be their escape route. That didn't work out for them. What I think is interesting is that the United States provided a priori a warning to Moscow without targetable intelligence, but in terms of what I would call that environmental intelligence, which is there is a terrorist attack that is imminent. These are the kind of the circumstances around which we could expect that. That's very difficult. As a guy who grew up in the intel world, that becomes in many cases background noise. You get enough of those all the time. You kind of go, thank you, but what can I do with that information? Well, at the strategic and operational level, there are some things you can do. Where are you vulnerable? Go through that analysis and then put your focus and your capacity where you can. Russia didn't do that. Didn't take our counsel. We weren't asking them to take our counsel, but we were providing them intelligence that we thought was worthwhile. I see this, I may be totally off on a tangent here, but I see this as, and the enemy of my enemy can be my friend. And if we all agree that terrorism is an existential threat and that the only way you deal with terrorism is you don't have a discussion with terrorist organizations. You don't try to convert terrorist organizations. What you do is you kill terrorist organizations and those that are within them. Just you do it, and you do it publicly. The challenge we have is that we now have a very risky and I think atrophying relationship with Russia. There may be an opportunity here where the United, and the Muslim population, the North-South Caucasus, if you will, the Chechens, the Groznys of the world, they have a very strong vitriolic relationship with Putin. This was a strike in Moscow against Putin's credibility. The United States and Russia could, let's put that in quotes, find a pathway where there could be some sharing in terms of our efforts directly against terrorist organizations as they affect that regime and as they affect our administration.
In keeping with the, in the vein of opportunity, let's circle back to the conflict in Israel and Gaza to address one last question from the audience. Every participant would love your point of view on how you see China, Europe, or other players, their role in potentially providing some resolution to the Israel-Hamas conflict. General Marks, let's start with you.
The only way that the fighting in Gaza is going to stop is if both parties agree to it. That hasn't been a successful effort so far. I don't think there will be the insertion of a force to make peace. And as Mastin and I understand from our experiences, there's a significant difference between making peace and keeping peace. So if there's no agreement that the fighting is going to cease, Israel will continue with its operations and it will at some point declare success and will end up with a ravaged Gaza. Israel doesn't care about the governance of Gaza. They just don't want a Gaza that's going to threaten them again. A third party is going to have to come in, whether that's under UN auspices or maybe that could be the Arab League, since they have a significant dog in this fight. There has to be a third party. Could that third party be a China who comes in and say, we want to maintain some type, let's be frank, some type of influence in this part of the world. We benefit from the market that this provides, from the access to energy resources that this area provides, this region provides. And China could step in and say, yeah, we want to be a part of it, but they would not be in the position to get their fingers dirty. This would have to be a win-win for them, which means there's got to be a cessation of the hostilities. There's got to be a ceasefire. It's got to be sustained in some manner. And then that potentially could be an opportunity for China, which would be devastating in my opinion. That's why I think the United States is working very hard to get a third party other than a Beijing to try to provide some type of a solution that both sides could agree to. And bear in mind, it's not both sides. It's Israel, it's Hamas, it's Hezbollah, it's Iran, it's the neighbors. They all have to sign up for what's going to take place next.
Yeah, a very important note. General Robinson, your thoughts on who can help influence some sort of brokered peace?
I mean, I still would love to see Saudi Arabia and the Abraham Accords be what influences this, but they won't be able to influence Iran, but they may be able to influence sufficient isolation from Iran that allows Israel to do pretty much what Joe Marks was talking about. And they really, I don't really see a solution that Israel's going to buy into that doesn't end with that as being the end state.
Well, Peter, I want to give you the last word. Given everything that we've discussed, how do you want our clients to think about the current climate? What can they be armed with moving forward throughout their day and the rest of the week, given some of the topics we've covered today?
Yeah, I think tactically, you've got to be concerned that we're going to see something that causes oil to spike, that you get some growth in China, that you have some disruption, or that we force Iran not to sell oil. So I think that to me is probably front and center is that. And then strategically, I think you've got to be thinking, okay, how dependent am I on these countries? And if we're wrong, and if they don't come back, again, I think Yellen was, Treasury Secretary Yellen was over in China trying to figure out some way that we can be more cooperative. And I think the reality is it's going to be incredibly difficult once we've drawn a line and said, these are no-go. You cannot use equipment that's good for AI. You cannot do military. I think it's a little bit of wishful thinking that we're going to come up with something that works for both. So I think you have to view China as this competitor, and that you're going to see Chinese brands. You're going to see effort by China to sell more and more. And that's where you've got to watch. And then I think the other thing we've learned from this recent conflict is we're often, despite all this that we talk about, somewhat taken by surprise, and you still have North Korea sitting out there with nuclear arsenal. They've kind of been off everyone's radar screen. That's something is, to me, it's a unexposed threat. So again, I just think there is so much geopolitical risk out there. People talk about it, but aren't trying to position their portfolios. And I think you have to, and I think the best way is going to be mostly either through the dollar, not through yields, but through energy. And that to me is probably my biggest, I want to own energy. I want to own commodities, because I think the geopolitical risk will feed into that very well, unfortunately.
Peter, thank you so much for your point of view. General Robinson, General Spider Marks, thank you so much for joining us today. To the audience, thank you for your participation, your time, and your questions. As always, the Academy team will continue to keep everyone up to date as this situation evolves through our sit reps, through our webinars, and of course, our Around the World that comes out at the end of every month. Thank you for taking time out of your day to join us. And if you have any follow-on questions, please reach out to your Academy relationship manager. We'd be happy to address them as the days and the weeks progress. Or you can reach out to info@academysecurities.com with any unanswered questions. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you to our listeners for taking the time. As Rachel mentioned, if you would like to engage with our geopolitical intelligence group directly, please email us at info@academysecurities.com. Academy Securities is a services-abled, veteran-owned investment bank with a social mission to mentor, hire, and train military veterans to develop careers in finance. I'm your host, Andy Robinson, and I look forward to sharing with you again soon.